This morning's lesson is somewhat of an introduction to the biblical world itself. Going to be a little bit of geography in the beginning to show the lands of the Bible, and then we'll deal more specifically in our introduction here with how archaeology can contribute to our understanding of Scripture. So with that in mind, we proceed to the biblical world. The world of the Bible is actually just a small part of the globe when we think in terms of where most of the events of the Bible took place. And when we think in terms of specifically the land of the patriarchs and then the land of Israel, it's again just a small portion of the globe, and yet the events of the Bible transpired in those places. When you look at Israel itself, it's helpful. Some of you have studied the Waldron's History and Geography manual of the Bible, and this is a map that Brother Bob and Sandra used. But there are four longitudinal zones in the land of Israel that define the land, and here they are: the coastal zone, the central hill country, again running up and down the Jordan Valley, and then the Transjordan Plateau. And just knowing things like that will determine where people could farm, where people could live, areas that were not very inhabitable, and where cities would be built. And so, again, those are the features of the land that people had to work with. The land itself is sometimes called the land of Canaan, who was a grandson of Noah. Canaan itself, in the Bible, does not refer to the both sides of the Jordan, only to the west side. We generally use it just interchangeably with the land of Israel, meaning both sides. But biblically, Canaan was only on the west side. You know that's right because you remember Moses did not get to go to the promised land, but he was on the eastern side at Mount Nebo on the Transjordan looking over, but he wasn't considered in the promised land. That was not the land of Canaan. Sometimes it's called the promised land, promised to Abraham and his seed, and it's called the land of Israel because Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and thus the land is called after his name. Sometimes you see the word Palestine. This really came into being more so in the days of the Romans, and it is a derivative of the word Philistine. And Palestine actually referred to both sides of the Jordan River. Again, the land of Israel itself, you have in the Bible, for example, it will say in the last verse of 1 Samuel chapter 3, that all of Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. That expression, Dan, that's in the north, to Beersheba. I know the print is small. Unless you're really up front, you might not can see that, but you can see the red arrows. But that's the totality of the land. And you'll see that expression a lot of times when a biblical writer wanted to reference from top to bottom the total population, he'd say from Dan to Beersheba. The thing about the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, it's referred to as a land bridge. It is a bridge that connects three continents: the continent of Africa, the continent of Asia, and the continent of Europe. And on either side, you've got a sea of water and a sea of sand, and a narrow strip right here that's called the land bridge. And even today, if you're wondering why there is so much attention to that part of the world, it's because it is still a very strategic location. And the one that controls this has more of a key to wealth and power and travel and a number of things that are considered important. So God put his people there, though. You can see his wisdom in that. In a sense, they would be isolated, but because the caravans would travel through Israel from Mesopotamia to Egypt, for example, armies would march, people would have opportunity to be in contact with a knowledge of the true God. And yet, as Israel became more and more like the nations round about them, they failed to show other nations the true God as they could have because of their very location. Again, this is just introducing somewhat of the land, but you can section the land looking here to the north. Highest point is right here, Mount Hermon. Already you're well below sea level here at the Sea of Galilee, about 696 feet below sea level. The Jordan Valley continues. You're looking at the hill country of Samaria. This is Galilee. The Golan Heights, Transjordan, the lowest point of the face of the earth right here, the Dead Sea, the Negev, this is Beersheba, and again, the mountains of Moab and so forth here to your right. So it has been said, I don't know if you remember Hester's book entitled Heart of the Hebrew History, but in his book he made this point. It was a book used in college for a number of years, and you can still get it, I think, as a used if it's not in print. But anyway, he makes the point that there is no place on the face of the earth that has as much variety as the land of Israel for the size of the land. We mentioned that 150 miles from Dan to Beersheba. Let's see some variety that is there. That land includes sea level. This is at Joppa. You know, when I say that, I know that there's some good Bible students in here, and I know you're thinking of things that you can associate here. This is where Jonah came. You remember, to get on a ship and to try to run away from God? This is where Solomon had the cedars of Lebanon floated down in rafts to this point and then taken to build the temple overland to Jerusalem. This is where Peter healed Dorcas from the dead. This is where Peter was when Cornelius was seeking the Lord, and Peter went up the coast to Caesarea. So a lot of things happen at these events, but right now I'm just saying that's sea level. You move on inland 35 miles, you're 2,550 feet above sea level at Jerusalem. But you keep on traveling just about another 14 miles to the west and slightly north, and you're at Jericho. And Jericho is 800 feet below sea level. At Jericho, they grow all kinds of things. It's a tropical-like climate. You'll see them growing dates. You'll see them growing tangerines, bananas, oranges. All manner of fruit and nuts are grown there. There are several oases at Jericho. If you're at Jerusalem, you would need a coat, maybe in the spring. But you're going down to Jericho, and you'd want to take that off and make sure you had your water bottle so you wouldn't dehydrate. But you go just a little further south of Jericho, and you come to the lowest point on the face of the earth, the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is many times more salty than ocean water. You cannot sink in the Dead Sea. I don't know that you could drown in the Dead Sea unless you just stood and put your face in and just tried to commit suicide. I mean, you have to deliberately do it. You can just, it is so buoyant. It's not only the lowest point on the face of the earth, but on the northern part of the Dead Sea, it's another 1,200 feet deep at that point. It gets more shallow as you go down. My friend Bob Waldron traveled with me when I took a group to Israel in 2009. You know the excellent job Bob did and Sandra in their book, but he had made the point that in that part of the world it never rains. Well, you know, never say never. And so on the trip where we were, yes, it rained, and again, I don't know how well you can see, but do you see this light-colored stuff? This is a wadi that is just running with debris and mud and right into the Dead Sea in a storm. And I took this photo on that occasion a little further south, and that's something you'll not see very often. We're back a distance. Can you see the shimmering light right there? That's the sea, and that's a rainbow. You won't see a rainbow over the Dead Sea very often. The guide that I used, who since then had a stroke and died, unfortunately, but I'd used him and known him for many years, and he said that of all the time, and he lived in Israel, and he said of all the times, all the groups he had taken to the Dead Sea, and all the times he had been there, he said, that's the only time I've seen a rainbow. So it's a rare thing. It's a rare thing. But it does occasionally rain there. But that's the Dead Sea. Let's go up north. Up north, the Jordan River. J.W. McGarvey said this is the most famous river in the world. But it's not the most famous river in the world for the reason that make other rivers famous. Other rivers are famous for their size. This is not a large river. Other rivers are famous for navigational purposes. The Jordan does not serve well with that. Other rivers, thirdly, are famous because of large cities that are built on their banks. The Jordan River has no cities of significance on its banks. And yet it's the most famous river in all the world because of the Bible, because Jesus was baptized in the Jordan, because John baptized in the Jordan, because Israel crossed the Jordan to Canaan's land, because Naaman was baptized there. All the things that happened at the Jordan in the Bible. But just a little bit further north, we come here to the Sea of Galilee, which is a freshwater body. And today, as in the days of Jesus, this was fished commercially. In fact, in the days of Jesus, fish would have been processed nearby at Magdala and imported by Rome from there. And so there was a great deal of industry associated with this. There were actually 16 seaports that were built around the Sea of Galilee. The ruins of the harbors can still be identified. But let's go a little further to the north. And here we are at the highest point of elevation. This is Mount Hermon. And this is more than 9,000 feet above sea level. And you see there is snow here. It's not snow-capped all the year round. But in one trip, you can see from sea level to the lowest point of the face of the earth, where you'll, it may be 110 degrees at the Dead Sea, but you come up north and you're seeing here snow-capped mountains. You're seeing desert. You're seeing oases, sea level to the mountain range, and all of this in that 150 miles from Dan to Beersheba. This is another shot of Mount Tabor. Mount Hermon. And incidentally, at the foothills of Mount Hermon is Caesarea Philippi, right over here, which, again, of course, is where Jesus made that promise to build his church. Let me show you one of my favorite views. Let's go up to Mount Carmel. Could I ask a question? I know that Joe and Connie have been to Israel, and Sister Holloway has been to Israel. Am I right? Has anyone else been to Israel here? Would you raise your hand if you have? Anybody? Joe, I don't know about you, but one of my favorite spots was to get to go to Mount Carmel. And the reason is, not only because of its association with Elijah, the prophet, and the defeat of the Baal prophets, but also just what you can see up there. Let me show you what you can see. You're looking out at the Jezreel Valley. It's also called the Valley of Esdraelon. And let me show you something that is mentioned in the biblical text. Over there in 1 Kings 18, where Elijah kills the Baal prophets, it says after God came down with fire and accepted his offering, and the people started shouting, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God," Elijah said, "Seize those Baal prophets, let none of them escape." And it says he took them down to the brook Kishon, to the river Kishon. And standing up here at Mount Carmel, oops, wrong button. Sorry, hold on. There we go. The tree line right here, that's the Kishon River. And it continues its flow and empties in the Mediterranean Sea like that. So while standing here, you can see where those Baal prophets were killed. But that's not all. We look further, and we can see in the distance here, we can see Mount Tabor. And just before that, you can see right here the Mount of Precipitation, and this is where Nazareth is located. Mount Tabor is mentioned in Judges 5. That's where Deborah was the judge, but it was Barak that led the forces of Israel against Sisera and the Canaanites. But that's where that battle took place. But we move just a little bit further, and there's another mountain you can see, and this is the hill of Moreh in Judges chapter 7. It mentions that this is in the time of Gideon, that the Midianites numbered 135,000, and they were camped on the north side of the valley. Now, Gideon was on the other side, but they were camped over here, and Gideon could see them from the spring of Harod. You can also see from here the pass that goes on into Gilead. And you can see in the distance over here Mount Gilboa. Remember that in 1 Samuel 31? That's where Saul and three of his sons were slain at Mount Gilboa. Closer shot of that. And I'll tell you the kind of thing that archaeology can help with. You know the way the book of Joshua is structured. 24 chapters, the first 12, the taking of the land, 13 through 24, dividing the land according to the 12 tribes. Well, in chapter 12, what it does there, it's just a summary chapter. It names a city, one king. City, king, city, king, and it just goes through there. That's what the chapter does, just summarizing all that's been taken. And then it's going to say it's going to mention this one time in the Bible. It's going to say in Joshua 12 and verse 22 that Jokneam was taken. And it turns out later this would be one of the Levitical cities. But because this was on the Via Maris, the international highway that traveled from Mesopotamia to Egypt, this was a very important city. Now here again, I'm just reading along and I see it, and are you like me, just kind of passed over that for years? But Jokneam. And so archaeologists have done a lot of excavation of this city and have shown that it was really an important city in the days of the Bible. Again, among the 31 Canaanite kings defeated by Joshua. So you can see all that from Mount Carmel. Now, we're still at Mount Carmel, and we're just looking down. All we're doing is turning clockwise, and we're looking down at the central hill country of Samaria. Do you remember in the days of King Ahab, he was battling with the Syrians? And the Syrians lost to a much smaller force of Israel, and they were shaking their heads. What is going on? They're having a war council. And somebody said, well, I know what it is. Their God is the God of the hills. We'll have a battle. We'll pull them down into the valleys, and we will we'll defeat them there. God sent a prophet to Ahab. He said, get your armies ready again. I'll show the Syrians I'm the God of the valleys also. But why did the Syrians say they're the God of the He's the God of the hill country? It's because most of the population at that time was not on the coastal region. It was in the hill country of Samaria. That's where Israel's population would have been. So again, knowing the geography there helps to make sense of that. And here we're going to do just one final turnaround to complete our turn. And that's the Mediterranean Sea that you're seeing shining right there in that photo. Now, the point of it is, all of that you can see from Mount Carmel, all those biblical events, sites that, again, have been identified and have been excavated and worked on by archaeologists. Could I mention a little bit about the flora and fauna of the Bible while we're introducing the biblical world? Amos, in Amos chapter 5 and verse 7, made reference to those of you who turn justice into wormwood. Do you know what wormwood is? Well, wormwood is actually, you see this green shrub-like thing here growing here? That's biblical wormwood, and it's very, very bitter. Now, righteousness should be a good thing. It should be a pleasant thing. We should delight in righteousness. We should hunger and thirst after righteousness. But they had turned righteousness into wormwood. And they had turned justice to wormwood and lay righteousness to rest in the earth, the text says. As you travel in the land, you see wildflowers just growing along. This is at Beit Shemesh. You remember Beit Shemesh? That's where the ark was returned by the Philistines. The acacia tree. I photographed this one in the Sinaitic Peninsula. It's a very large tree. I stood under this and just looked and saw, Charles, you can make several cuts from that. Now, you can't really see a ratio here, but I'll tell you, before I took this photo, there was a car parked under there for shade and people walking around. It's really a large tree. I mention that because the structure for the tabernacle, remember the boards were made out of acacia wood, and much of the furniture as well. The date palm, Judges 4, verse 5, Deborah sat under a palm tree and rendered judgment to Israel. If you go to Israel, you may be able to have lots of dates. Amos mentioned that before he was called to be a prophet of the Lord, that he was a tender of sycamore fruit. Now, growing up in Alabama, you know about sycamore trees. But the sycamore tree of the Bible is not like our sycamore tree. This is a tree that produces figs. They're not the best figs. They're eaten by the poorer people of the land. But when he says he was a tender of sycamore trees, he was in the fig production business. Now, if you want to see some good figs, these are good figs right here. Better figs. And they are often dried and very nourishing. Again, that's part of the biblical world. But something so important in the biblical world is the olive. The anointing with olive oil, using it for food, using it for medicinal purposes, it was widely used. The pomegranate. Let me share with you guys something you might want to keep in mind. If there's a lovely lady that is very dear to you, You might quote her Song of Solomon, chapter 4 and verse 3, which says, "Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil." Now see, if she knows that's from the Song of Solomon, she knows you have really paid her a compliment, a slice of pomegranate. Pretty complexion, don't you see? The grapes, the fruit of the vine, again, this is so much a part of the biblical world. And even today, as you travel, you can see many vineyards producing grapes. But I said flora and fauna. Let me mention to you in Numbers 22 and verse 23, rather, in verse 22, Balaam makes reference to Israel as having the strength of the wild ox. Now, when you hear that word wild ox, what comes to your mind? Well, this is the wild ox that is native to the Bible. When clean and unclean foods are listed in Deuteronomy chapter 14 and verse 5, it mentions, among others, the desert antelope. This is the desert antelope that was said to be clean for food. Also, it mentions deer in the same verse as being clean for food, as well as other animals. In Psalm 104 and verse 18, the high hills are for the wild goats. This was very hilly country where I took this photo at Ein Gedi. Reference is made in Proverbs 30, verse 26, to the coney or the badger, the rock badger. And it says that they're creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. And so this is the biblical rock badger. By the way, he was not clean to eat, and I'm sure he's glad of that. This, by the way, I took it aside on the shore of Galilee, mentioned one time in Scripture, this is Dalmanutha. And at Ein Gedi, some more. Can you see those? They're so much the color of the rocks. See them right there? They just really are camouflaged very well. You know, reference is also made to the biblical stork. Jeremiah 8 and verse 7 is a very sad passage. It says, "Even the stork in the heavens knows her appointed times, but my people do not know the judgment of the Lord." Do you know that the storks migrate? They migrate from Africa to Turkey. And they don't fly up across the Mediterranean. They follow the land bridge. They fly over the land bridge of Israel and make their flight that way. How do they know how to do that? I took this photo. This was near biblical Troas. I thought, wow, those are some big birds. And right after I put up my camera, the mama bird flew down. A lot bigger than they were. And the mama bird fed these, and these big old birds held their beaks open and were fed by the mama bird. But God is saying, these birds act with the instinct I've given them. They behave like they're supposed to, but my people don't know the judgments of the Lord. Isn't that sad? And there are many references beginning in Genesis chapter 12 to the camel as well as the lowly donkey. Jesus rode a donkey into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry. On the last day, there will be the goats on the left hand and the sheep on the right. The Lord is my shepherd. Again, this is entering the biblical world. Elders are called shepherds. Ben Anderson wrote a book called They Smell Like Sheep in terms of the close association of shepherds with the sheep. The cattle on a thousand hills are mine. By the way, I took this in Bethlehem in the Galilee, these cattle right here. Let me look at Israel's neighbors for just a minute. We've looked at Israel itself. We've looked at its variety. We've looked at flora and fauna. Let me show you what is surrounding Israel. You've got the up to the north and east, Mesopotamia, which is defined by two rivers, the Tigris River. I was fortunate to get this particular photo here because this whole area, a dam is being constructed, and all of this will be underwater, apparently pretty soon. But again, another shot here of the Tigris River. The Tigris is the smaller of the two. This is the Euphrates River, quite a bit larger. So again, this defines what is called the Fertile Crescent as it reaches on down to the land of Israel itself, including the Orontes River in Syria, as well as the Jordan River in Israel. But that defines the Fertile Crescent. Here again, that's why ancient civilizations built there. That's why people traveled that way. You know, you'd say, well, if you're going from this point to this point, it looks like you just go right across. People did not travel that way. Unless it was an army and a forced march, people never traveled that way. They traveled where the cities were. They traveled where there was water, where they could buy food and lodging from time to time. So again, Mesopotamia. To the south, you've got the Arabian Desert to the south and east. And a lot of it is just desert, but at Petra, you have what was an international trade network and the capital of the Nabataeans in the days of the New Testament. The most well-preserved of all the ancient high places where pagan worship was offered is to be found at Petra. And then to the south and to the west, you have the Sinaitic Peninsula that especially becomes important from the standpoint that this will be Israel's home for 40 years during the 40 years wandering. It is a rough, rough, rugged area. There is very little water. And again, this would be the site of Israel's wandering for those 40 years. Then we look a bit at the land of Egypt. The capital of Egypt for many years was Memphis, which is to the north. But you know, up is down. The north is lower Egypt. You know how that works at the Delta area. But at Memphis, there's very little left. But you can see this Sphinx of solid alabaster of Ramesses, a statue of Ramesses. There's just not a lot left at what was such an important city. And that fulfills Ezekiel's prophecy where God said he would bring it to naught. There's just almost nothing there. At Egypt, you can see the Step Pyramid and the Great Pyramids of Giza and here's the Khafre Sphinx, Giza, I meant to say a while ago, the Nile River. And let's move on to the north. In Old Testament times, this was the kingdom of the Hittites. And it was largely defined by the Halys River as far as the center of power. Hattusis was the capital. This was the great temple at Hattusis. The Apostle Paul would say when he wrote to the Romans, though, of that same area, I preached from Jerusalem to Illyricum, and I'm ready to preach to those of you that are in Rome also. So in the days of Paul, that's going to be, again, the scene of his journeys, 1, 2, and 3. Well, let me say more specifically about some things that archaeology can contribute. There are so many references to pagan gods. It's taken me a long time to understand just how permeated the biblical world was with idolatry. And how unique. I mean, we're so familiar with the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. And from our earliest childhood, we probably heard of that. And we're not shocked by that. But I'll tell you when that was first given. That would be a very shocking thing, because there was no other nation that just had one God. Even if they had a favorite God, their special God, they would acknowledge that other nations had gods. They're just not as good as ours. But they believed in many gods. All of them did. Israel and Israel alone was defined by faith in the one true and living God. And the others freely made images devoted to their gods. And God forbade the making of any image to represent him. But again, archaeologists have helped us to see all those passages that show in Old Testament times how Israel kept being tempted to go back into idolatry, and it's just such a perpetual problem. See, the world around us, the tendency is to conform to it. And so archaeology can help us with that. Aphrodite, the god of love. Osiris, the god of the afterlife. This is called Ashdodah. This is a Philistine chair deity. It is suggested that this may have had arms that held a baby. I don't know about that, but that's what scholars say. This bronze bull was excavated near Samaria in Israel. Baal. This is an Ammonite god. This is in the Israeli Museum today. In Mesopotamia, Shamash, the sun god, who's seen here seated on his throne, was worshipped. But you know, closer by, at Bethsaida in Galilee, there was an image of the sun god found there. It was everywhere. Baal was worshipped widely. Hathor in Egypt worshipped widely, not just there, but all over. The Apis bull, the Egyptians had a sacred bull that was a living sacred bull, one at a time, that they worshipped. He was deified. And when he died, he was embalmed, and he was put in a pyramid, just like a pharaoh. And so it was widely practiced. When Israel left Egypt and turned to idolatry at Mount Sinai, what, do you remember, did they make? The golden calf? Where do you reckon they came up with that idea? You see, God took Egypt. He took Israel out of Egypt. But Egypt was not out of them yet. Bes is the god who is supposedly the protector of expectant mothers. The falcon god represented the deified Pharaoh. Let me show you how this is illustrated. You know, if you didn't know that, here is Kephron that I mentioned a while ago, that the great Sphinx, this is the Pharaoh that built the great Sphinx. Can you see seated right up here on his shoulder is a falcon? Now, you might think if you didn't know anything about that, he must have liked birds, or that was his pet bird. But no, this is symbolic. That's showing he's recognized as divine, and that in the afterlife, again, he's represented by the falcon. So the falcon god is on his shoulder for that association right there to designate him as being divine. The twin colossi of Memnon guards the valley of the kings. But in the land of Egypt, up at Hazor, this is where Baal worship took place to the north. You remember that Jeroboam built the golden calf at Dan and Beersheba. This is the altar at the location of Dan to the north, where for 200 years Israel came and committed idolatry. It's everywhere. I took a group just this spring to Turkey and Greece. This is a city mentioned one time in the Bible. This is Assos, where Paul went after Troas on the way back to Jerusalem. And a temple to the goddess Athena is there. Recently in Laodicea, yet another temple has been unearthed there. One other thing here on this, a different subject, but these are knuckle bones. I photographed these at Amphipolis. And this would be used like for casting lots as well as playing games. But sometimes the casting of lots is mentioned. Well, let me just mention one other thing in the 3 minutes we have left here, and it's going to work out just right on the timing. Archaeology can contribute to our understanding of ancient writing, and especially and specifically to biblical manuscripts. They've spent a lot of time studying Akkadian cuneiform, which was the international language of Mesopotamia. That would eventually give rise to the writing in script form and more of what we know as the alphabet. But again, archaeologists study that and know the various periods that this fits in. And so sometimes they're studying, as we'll mention in our next period, documents that directly pertain to the biblical period. This is a very important discovery right here. This is called the Gezer calendar, and it is the oldest example of Hebrew script. And this dates actually back to about 1,000 years before Christ. And what this was a schoolboy's exercise. He was naming the months of the year and, you know, what you do in each month, when the harvest comes, when the planting comes, and the different things like that. But that's considered very important. And I'll conclude with this one, with a few slides about this one. I was showing this one time, and somebody said, "What's that thing that looks like an egg roll?" Well, that's not an egg roll. That's actually a piece of silver. It's what silver looks like that dates back to the time of Solomon's temple. And that very important discovery was found in this tomb right there in Jerusalem, chamber 25, cave 24, at Kephet Hinnom. And so these scrolls were unrolled. There are actually two of them. And they're now in the Israeli Museum. And what they are is a quotation from Numbers chapter 6. One is more complete than the other. This one is the more complete, but it's the high priestly prayer. May the Lord bless you and keep you, lift his countenance upon you, make his face to shine upon you and give you peace. The prayer with which the priest would bless the people of Israel. And so this is actually the oldest surviving fragment of Scripture. It goes back to when Solomon's temple was still standing. That's the second of the two right there.